Hi, I'm Rick Ryman, host of Audibly Speaking, a show on the stories behind the stories of our time. By sounding out on these stories, we give voice to them and hear them for the first time. From the news of the day to history and literature, from audiobooks to leaders on the stump, we examine the backstories of our time, audibly speaking. Lee Harvey Oswald has been a tough nut to crack in terms of trying to decide what his motives were from one point to another in 1963, and as the year proceeded and approached the time in which he assassinated President Kennedy in November 1963. Oswald seemed to have a lot of contempt for people he thought were below his intellectual level, and that included just about everybody who was in his orbit. So he wasn't very much inclined to explain what he was all about, what he was trying to achieve. He seemed to take great delight in covering up his motives. And that has made it very difficult for people in the aftermath of the assassination to determine what his intentions were, what his motives were throughout 1963. Clearly, at the end of April 1963, he and Marina wanted to get out of Dallas because the heat was on. Oswald had tried to assassinate retired General Edwin Walker on April the 10th, and in the wake of that failed attempt to assassinate Walker, the police were looking all over the place for the man who had fired the shot that nearly killed Walker. And Oswald, after a few days, began to relax because he was fairly sure that he would not be found, but no one could be sure. And Oswald always had a kind of worry ever since he was interrogated by the FBI in Fort Worth that the FBI would not leave him alone. Now, Oswald's strategies and motives seemed to change once he went to New Orleans in late April. He had family in New Orleans. His aunt Lillian and his uncle Dutch, Moret, were there, and Oswald had lived with them as a child for a short time. But he expected to use New Orleans as a place, as a platform, for him to build a resume that would impress Fidel Castro. The problem, Oswald recalled when he went to Moscow, was that he was unable to convince the Soviets in 1959 to give him a high-powered job in the Politburo, which he thought he was entitled to because of his intellectual brilliance on the question of Marxism. He thought he was unable to do that because he had no gifts to bring them. He had nothing to show other than his intellectual mind, which didn't seem to impress the Soviets. He did offer the Soviets to exchange his information that he had gotten from the Marines for some plum position in the Soviet Union, but that didn't seem to impress them either. So the Soviets originally turned down Oswald's request that he be allowed to stay in the Soviet Union, and they said he would have to leave by the time his tourist visa expired. Oswald attempted a real or fake suicide attempt in order to stay in the Soviet Union, and this bought him a little time, which actually caused the Russians to reconsider, and they allowed him to stay pending some kind of more permanent decision on what to do with this strange defector. And they allowed him to go to Minsk, or directed him to go to Minsk, where he lived as a lowly radio operator in a machine shop in Minsk. So Oswald, of course, was unhappy with the position he was given, but at least he was allowed to stay. But over the course of his life in the Soviet Union from 1959 to 1962, he became increasingly dissatisfied with Russian life. There was nothing to spend his money on. He had a very nice apartment, which he appreciated. And he had a lot of girlfriends who also were admiring of this strange and exotic American who had the wonderful apartment. But beyond that, Oswald thought that he was made for better things. And he thought that he should have some kind of position in some revolutionary organization that would respect his talents. And that wasn't going to happen in the bureaucracy of the Soviet Union. So gradually, Oswald became bored. He also tried to propose to a girlfriend in Russia, Ella Gurman, but she turned him down, and that left him dispirited. And on the whole, it appears that Oswald's dissatisfaction with the Soviet Union lay in the fact that he was unable to be a great man in the organization. Oswald always wanted to have some important job to do that would help him convince himself that he was the intellectual titan that he saw himself as. And if people did not show their respect for him, there was something lacking in his personality or in his equanimity towards life. So one of the goals Oswald had in life was to impress himself. There had to be an audience of two for Oswald. One of the members of the audience was himself. He wanted to impress himself by his successes in climbing the ladder of bureaucratic power within some kind of revolutionary movement. And he thought that the Soviets might be that place, might be that revolutionary movement. But when he got there, he found that he could stay, but that he could not climb. There was no future for him in Minsk. And so although he met Marina, proposed to her in part to make Ella jealous, which really didn't work, Oswald was not happy with the direction of his life. He was not happy with the lack of material comforts in Russia, and he was determined to get greater freedom of action by returning to the United States. There was no question about Oswald's hatred of the United States. He had never given that up. And he was going back to the United States with no illusions about what life would be like in the U.S. materially. But he thought that at least in the United States, he would have greater freedom of movement. Oswald was very much aware that there was no room for him to rise in any level, whether it be a material level or a political level in Russia. He was very much aware that the Russians were spying on him, that they were bugging his apartment, and that they were watching his every move. And so not only could he not move around in secret as he desired, but he couldn't actually put any plans into motion, even if he conceived them. So Oswald was never happy anywhere. As Marina once put it to the Warren Commission, maybe on the moon he would have been happy, but probably not even there. No matter where he was dissatisfied. And so if he got back to the United States, he had not yet lost his citizenship, so he could, in theory, get back to the United States. And if he could get back to the United States with Marina and his child in tow, then, he thought, he could parade around the United States as a former defector to the Soviet Union with a Russian wife and child. And in that way, he could impress people with his intellectual brilliance. He planned to write a book that he hoped would sell because it wasn't very usual for a former Marine to defect to the Soviet Union. And there had been a lot of attention on Francis Gary Powers, who was a CIA pilot who had been shot down in the Soviet Union and who had been exchanged for Rudolf Abel in a prisoner exchange and had gotten a lot of favorable press. It was, after all, the height of the Cold War. And so Oswald had good reason to think that upon his return to the United States, there would be a lot of attention focused upon him. And that was, again, one of the things Oswald wanted. He wanted attention. He wanted respect. He wanted people to think that he was a great man intellectually and as a political seer who could see into the future and perhaps be able to divine the political future of the world. He also wanted to be a revolutionary leader. He knew he couldn't be that in the United States, but he did believe that if he got back to the United States and he was not able to sell a lot of books or command a lot of attention, then he could develop a resume to take to Cuba to impress Fidel Castro, a resume of revolutionary activity, which was something he did not have when he went to the Soviet Union. And Oswald chalked up his failure to impress the Politburo in 1959 from the fact that he didn't have any gifts to bring. He didn't have any authority. He didn't have any resume that would impress them. And he would not make the same mistake with Fidel Castro. Oswald always saw Castro's revolution as a more hopeful jumping-off point for him because it was more youthful. It was younger. It was more in a gestational stage than the Soviet Union. He saw the leaders of the Politburo as a bunch of old men who were just trying to feather their own nests materially. But he saw in Fidel Castro a sincere young revolutionary, much like himself. And the plastic nature of the revolution, the fact that it was just getting started, seemed to offer a place for someone like Oswald. And of course, if Oswald was back in the United States, he would be very, very close to Castro, whether he was in Texas or in New Orleans. New Orleans was the second biggest city in terms of Cuban refugees in the United States. So Oswald thought he might be able to infiltrate some anti-Castro Cuban rebels and their groups in an effort to make a name for himself for Castro. He might also be able to form a chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba organization and impress Castro that way. Above all, Oswald hoped to use New Orleans as a place where he could contact political radicals in the United States who were sort of middle managers of the theoretical revolutionary movement in the United States, gain their trust, make them aware of him, and get letters of recommendation, in essence, from them that he could present to Castro to show his revolutionary credentials, that which he had lacked when he went to the Soviet Union. So there was a change in Oswald's strategy, quite clearly. In April, he had tried to assassinate Edwin Walker. That was the use of violence to prove his revolutionary stature. But in late April, he jumped to New Orleans and began to act in a peaceful way through political action that was radical, but not illegal or violent. And some people suggest that Oswald had changed radically, but the reality was that Oswald himself had not changed. He still saw the practical value of violence as a tool. It all went back to his assessment of the revolutionary situation when he wrote his book in 1962, The Collective, he called it. It was actually a draft. It was actually a fragment of a book. But Oswald hoped to expand it into a book. And in that draft, Oswald said that the revolutionary movements that were currently in political power, especially the Soviet Union, were not going to succeed, that the Soviet Union was just as corrupt and just as unlikely to bring about the communist utopia as was the United States, and that they were locked in a violent confrontation, a fight to the death, which could only end in the nuclear explosion and destruction of the entire world. That would not be the end of civilization, but it would be the end of life as we know it. And Oswald said that nothing short of that would lead to the ultimate communist utopia. Once both Titan nations, the United States and the Soviet Union, had destroyed the world together, a remnant of civilization would be able to pick up the pieces and eventually develop a communist utopia. But if you look at this prescription by Oswald, you can see how radical it is, but also how impractical it is, and how it doesn't really leave room for any kind of action or speech making or prescription for the future on the part of revolutionary radicals like Oswald. What could Oswald possibly do to bring about the destruction of the world? He couldn't do anything. What action could he take that would help bring the revolutionary utopia closer? He couldn't do it in civil rights by helping a movement like Martin Luther King Jr.'s. No, he couldn't do that. That wouldn't bring us closer if you had to have the destruction of the world through an atomic exchange before you could even hope to establish the utopia. So Oswald was painting himself in a corner intellectually with this book. But to Oswald, it simply meant that violence and symbolic actions were still to be sought. Violence against those who opposed the communist revolution, and symbolic actions such as an attempt to join a revolutionary movement like Fidel Castro's. At least if he could do the latter, if he could impress people with his intellectual acumen, if he could join Castro's movement, at least the audience of one, Lee Harvey Oswald, would be so suitably impressed and so feeling good about himself in such a material state of plenty and comfort with a radical wife and child that Oswald felt that he would be doing symbolically a sufficient job that would move the country closer to that utopia. Perhaps even he would be alive at the moment when perhaps he had helped to trigger the nuclear exchange that would set the stage for the utopia. There wasn't a lot of rationality in Oswald's theory, the collective, but there's also no evidence that Oswald ever abandoned it. And one of the consequences of this book was that Oswald was never, ever going to consider going back to the Soviet Union. That door had been closed, and Oswald, in his ego, believed that he himself had closed the door, not the Soviet bureaucracy for which he had so much contempt. But he did sincerely admire Fidel Castro, even though theoretically Castro was also engaging in a pointless exercise in trying to bring communism to Cuba, since that would not advance the revolutionary needle, or the utopian needle, I should say. Oswald still felt that there was a place for him in that movement that would cause him to have the kind of respect he thought he deserved. There was a kind of Rodney Dangerfield in Oswald. If he could not bring about the communist utopia, at least he could impress the revolutionary leaders that he admired himself so much. And so this was what his goal was in New Orleans, to develop the resume that he lacked when he went to the Soviet Union that he thought would allow him to slip into place in Castro's Cuba. Now, there was one other goal that Oswald had when he went to New Orleans, and that was to try to establish a pathway whereby he could attack Edwin Walker once more. And the Warren Commission did not notice this second goal of Oswald's. They noticed his resume pathway, but they didn't notice that Oswald was also trying to find another way to get back at Walker. And it must be observed that these two goals, to go to Cuba eventually, but also to assassinate Walker, which he had failed to do in April 1963, were harmonious goals. They were not in conflict. One was supposed to help lead to the other. And let me explain that theory a little bit more in this episode. Oswald's main activity in New Orleans was undoubtedly resume building. He spent a lot of time passing out Fair Play for Cuba leaflets. He had first contacted this organization in 1962, but he didn't resume the correspondence until early April 1963, when he asked Fair Play for Cuba when he asked the Fair Play for Cuba committee for 40 or 50 leaflets that he wanted to pass out on the streets of Dallas, he said. But once he got to New Orleans, he actually asked to be allowed to form a chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba committee in New Orleans. This would be a decoration on his resume. He also wrote to the leaders of the Socialist Party and the Socialist Labor Party of America to elicit responses that he could then go to Cuba with and show to Castro to demonstrate that he was known to the middle managers of American revolutionary socialism. And this was a pattern for Oswald, to use the media to connect himself to the higher-ups in organized socialism and to magnify his own self-importance and importance to others. Also in New Orleans, he infiltrated anti-Castro groups such as Carlos Bringer's, and he got arrested in the process, which was something he wanted to do to further make himself known not only to the press but also indirectly to Castro. His arrest made the New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper and allowed Oswald to cut out clippings of the newspaper article to show to the Cuban authorities in Mexico City, whose visa he wanted to procure, and then, of course, later to show to Castro. He also appeared in a radio program in New Orleans where he could debate Carlos Bringer and explain his socialist line to New Orleans listeners and, by extension, to Castro, once the article came to Castro's attention. Oswald, while in New Orleans, was as anxious to attract attention from the authorities as he had been anxious to avoid attracting attention when he lived in Dallas. Especially after the Walker shooting, he was keeping a low profile. But always, always, he told everyone in New Orleans that he had gone directly from Fort Worth to New Orleans, hiding his Dallas residence completely, and especially his residences on Elsbeth Street and Neely Street, which would have alerted the FBI to the fact that he was in the Dallas area at the time that Walker was shot at. When Oswald was arrested in New Orleans, he even asked to speak to an agent of the hated FBI, John Quigley, another way to show his credentials as a revolutionary locking horns with the notorious FBI, as Oswald called them. But Oswald also, day after day in New Orleans, was dry-firing his rifle on his New Orleans porch, practicing like a would-be assassin. He was borrowing a book, The Huey Long Murder Case, from the public library about the assassination of Huey Long, and books about James Bond. Oswald still was maintaining his ambition for action hero status of a most violent kind, and Bond was part of Oswald's pseudonym, Alec James Heidel, which was a mashup of Oswald's nickname in Russia, Alec, Heidel, which was a fusion of Fidel and Oswald's middle initial, and of course, James for James Bond. The Warren Commission acted like Oswald was depressed as he neared the day when he was going to Mexico City, dispirited and no longer interested in Walker when he set out to go to Mexico City for a visa to Cuba. The reality is far different. In addition to these activities in New Orleans, Oswald was also retaining pictures of Walker's backyard. When he burned his notebook a few days after the attack on Walker, Marina watched as he saved the pictures that were in the book of Walker's backyard. The only reason for saving them was that he would have another plan to finish the job on Walker at some future date. The pictures were of no value if he had no such plan. While he was in New Orleans, Oswald faked a plan to return to Russia alongside Marina. What happened was that Marina found him in the kitchen of her home, sobbing uncontrollably. She found him so depressed, she asked him what was wrong, and he said that he had finally decided to change his mind, and he wanted to go back to Russia with her. You recall that he had been pushing Marina time and time again to request a visa to go back to Russia. Just her, not him. Just her and the baby, but not him. But in the summer of 1963 in New Orleans, Oswald concocts this story in the kitchen and cries crocodile tears, saying that what he really wanted to do was to go back with her after all. This made Marina very happy because she thought that this was a sign that Oswald really did love her. And Oswald asked her to renew her request for a visa, this time a visa which would include a visa for him as well as for her. She happily did so. She wrote out the request. She handed to him, or she handed the envelope to him with the request, and behind her back, he proceeded to put a note in it that he really wanted the Russian authorities just to provide a visa for Marina only and to consider his request separately, as he put it. So what Oswald was doing was manipulating Marina into making another request to the Russian embassy, this time more emphatic than ever, when in fact he was really planning not to go to Russia at all, but to remain in the United States until such time as he could attack Walker again and make an effort to go to Cuba. By that time, he would need a visa to the Soviet Union, as events were to turn out, but he did not know that in the summer of 1963. He thought he could get to Russia without a visa to the Soviet Union. He thought he could get a clear and clean visa to Cuba and not have to worry about getting a transit visa through Cuba, dependent on a visa from the Soviet Union to procure that Cuban visa. That was what was going to happen later, but in the summer of 1963, Oswald did not know that. So Oswald was clearly manipulating Marina. That we know because of the note he slipped in with the letter in the envelope. It's likely as a result that his tears were not real, but were manipulated to make her more agreeable to the proposition. Yet the Warren Commission took this seriously, and the Warren Commission argued that Oswald was becoming increasingly depressed and dispirited, as shown by this incident. They thought he was being sincere, and as a result, they saw the attack on JFK in November as the action of a desperate man. And they also saw Oswald's trip to Cuba in October, the month before, as another act of a desperate man. Oswald was determined to go to Cuba simply because all his options had run out in the United States. But the reality was that Oswald was acting more like he was in command in the summer of 1963. There's very little evidence that Oswald was dispirited or depressed, probably because of his success in getting press attention, the arrest that brought him to prominence, the radio interview, which brought him even more prominence and allowed him to decorate his credentials and resume even more. Oswald was anything but dispirited and depressed. He was probably pumped up and more excited than ever. Another instance of this command attitude is Oswald's fake story about a hijacking of a plane in the late summer of 1963 in New Orleans. Oswald told Marina that he wanted her to join him in an effort to hijack a plane to Cuba. Oswald would hand her a pistol, and she would stand in the back of the plane while he commandeered the cockpit with another pistol. And it was up to Marina to keep all the passengers in line with her pistol, even though she would also have a baby in tow at the back of that plane. This is an utterly absurd story. And if you believe that Oswald was sincere, as the Warren Commission did, then it really does show a desperate man, a dispirited man who was trying anything he could to move the needle on his life. But the reality is this is another manipulation of Marina, because by threatening a hijacking of a plane to Cuba, he could make more palatable a later plan to go to Mexico City to request a visa to Cuba. That would seem more reasonable to Marina than a hijacking of an airplane. And Oswald was right. In comparison with a threat to hijack a plane, Marina almost certainly was more disposed to agree to a plan by Oswald to go to Mexico City in pursuit of a visa. Oswald also told Marina that he would come back to Dallas and not use the visa right away. Now, this is somewhat speculative. The reason why I suspect this is because Oswald told Marina that he would definitely be coming back, and he asked her what kind of present he wanted to bring back to her from Mexico City. So it does appear that Oswald was not planning to go to Cuba directly from Mexico City. We don't know for sure what he was planning, but he did not seem to have the requisite funds to support himself in Cuba, and he had not yet compiled the full and complete resume that he intended to compile before going to Cuba. The reason I say that is because at the top of that resume was the killing of Edwin Walker, which had not yet happened. And Oswald, no doubt, wanted to complete that plan before going to Cuba. How do we know that? Well, we know that on October 23rd, Oswald attended a presentation in Dallas, U.S. Day it was called, in which Edwin Walker harangued the crowd, speaking out against the Kennedy administration, speaking out against Fidel Castro, and Oswald was there. And the question is, if Oswald was dispirited and depressed, if he had given up his plan to get Walker to accomplish the assassination he had failed to accomplish in April, why on earth would he attend this event, which would be a kind of demonstration of his failure? He would simply be seeing the man he had failed to kill, and it would be a stark reminder of the fact that he had forever failed in his most revolutionary quest so far. But if Oswald was still planning to shoot Walker, then he could see this as part of his plan. He could see this as a kind of stalking of Walker, something that was a prelude to something more successful than what happened on April the 10th. So obviously Oswald had not forgotten about Walker, and his attendance at U.S. Day on October 23rd in Dallas, the day before Adlai Stevenson gave his presentation on UN Day in the same location, which Oswald did not attend, makes no sense unless Oswald's plans to finish the job with Walker was still on his agenda. A journalist named Albert Newman has made many of these assertions, and I agree with these speculations. I agree that Oswald was still aiming his fire at Edwin Walker. It was not a conflict with his resume building. It was another way to flesh out that resume and make it even more attractive to the Cubans. After all, Walker was one of the leading enemies of the Cuban Revolution in the United States, and by tying his name to Walker, by connecting himself directly to Walker through an assassination, not just an assassination attempt, Oswald could burnish his credentials so much that Fidel Castro could hardly deny entrance to Oswald. At the end of October, Oswald probably thought he had more time, but November 1st was a new day. And what happened on November 1st, as we've already seen in this series of podcasts, is that the FBI made a visit to the Irving home of Ruth Payne, startling Marina and shaking up Oswald when he found out about it a couple of days later. That was not the only visit by the FBI to the Irving home of Ruth Payne. James Hostie, the FBI agent, visited again just prior to November 8th, when Oswald returned to Irving for his weekend visit. So Oswald was rattled by two visits by the FBI to Ruth Payne's home, because until November 1st, he thought he had successfully prevented the FBI from knowing that he lived in Dallas at the time of the Walker shooting. He thought that he had successfully shaken off the FBI from any concern for him. But the two visits of Hostie to Ruth Payne's home, and what Hostie inadvisably told Ruth and Marina, was that the FBI was not only aware that Oswald was living in Dallas, but they didn't know exactly where in Dallas. They were also aware that Oswald had passed out leaflets for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. And finally, he knew now that they knew that he had gone to Mexico City. Oswald took that for granted because he knew that the CIA was covering the embassy closely. Now, after November 1st, and especially the second visit, a few days later by Hostie, Oswald knew that the FBI probably knew that he had been to Mexico City, certainly knew that he had engaged in radical activities in New Orleans, and also knew that he was living somewhere in Dallas, where Edwin Walker also lived. So starting in November, Oswald was shaken up. He believed that his freedom of action was coming to a close, or possibly coming to a close. He had no design whatsoever to assassinate the President of the United States, because nobody even knew there would be a motorcade in Dallas until November the 16th. We know this for a fact. Prior to November the 16th, there was no guarantee that there would be any motorcade at all, and there was no sign whatsoever that if there was a motorcade, it would go by the Texas School Book Depository. In fact, on Friday, November 15th, the Dallas Morning News published an article that there almost certainly would not be a motorcade in Dallas because there would not be enough time. But on Saturday, November the 16th, for the first time, the Dallas Morning News not only confirmed that there would be a motorcade, but published the route that anyone remotely familiar with the street plan of Dallas would recognize would take the motorcade directly past the Texas School Book Depository building. That was when Oswald got the earth-shaking news that the president would be within his reach on November 22nd. We'll look more at Oswald's last few weeks and what they show about his motives and intentions in our next podcast episode. That's it for today's episode of AudiblySpeaking.com. New podcast episodes appear on AudiblySpeaking.com approximately once every 2 weeks. Please subscribe to Audibly Speaking on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you enjoy. Until next time, this is Rick Ryman. Happy listening!